Coming up today, inside the Great Chicken Crisis of 2018, Brian Eno's new augmented reality experience, and we meet the couple that cost Google $2.1 billion. You're listening to episode 357 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host Matt Burgess, and joining me today is Roland Manfort.
Hello.
Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
And Vicky, slightly ill, Turk.
Hello.
You're a little bit croaky, aren't you?
A little bit. I'm going to try not to cough on the microphone, but apologies in advance.
Can you hit us with something that you've learned this week?
So I have been watching the Winter Olympics, as I'm sure many people have. There's only 2 days left. It wraps up on the 25th, I believe. And one of my favourite things to watch is the figure skating, because it's just beautiful. And I learned that only two women figure skaters had successfully landed a triple axel jump in an Olympic competition before American skater Mirai Nagasu did in Pyeongchang when she competed. So it was an amazing moment. The crowd went wild when she landed this jump. And I wanted to figure out why this jump was so hard. So it's kind of a bit of, I don't know much about figure skating, but I know that like the triple axel has this real aura around it. It's something that everyone goes for and it's really hard to do. And apparently it's because you have to take off facing forward, but land facing backwards. So you actually have to turn 3.5 times in the air, which makes it a lot harder than any of the other triple jumps.
How do they not get dizzy? That's what I always think, especially with like the snowboarding
skill,
where they do like 4 or 5 backflips or whatever in one go.
There's a really good video on the Wired US site of like a regular guy trying to do just the turns on a trampoline, and the most he can get around is 1.5 times, because you just got to be so strong to turn your body in the air like that.
Yeah, so the triple axel is 3.5 turns. Wow. You must have to get so much height to do that as well.
That's pretty incredible. Roland, is there anything that you learned this week?
Yes, I learnt what the error code 402 means. So you all know about 404. That's kind of the famous error code, which means page not found. But there's a whole bunch of these error codes, and one of them is 402. And if you go to the original internet protocols and the status codes they developed for that, then it says reserved for future use. But the actual intention was to have it as part of a system of micropayments. So it would say payment not completed or something like that. And I think that's really interesting, because obviously like with all this kind of blockchain cryptocurrency stuff, one of the ideas is that you could have a system of payments that would be as kind of dispersed and as sort of small level as the internet, if you see what I mean. And the reason that that's necessary or might be useful is goes all the way back to the founding of the internet, when nobody put in the micropayment system because it would be kind of too complicated and didn't seem that important at the time. I found that really fascinating.
So we could get the 402 error in the future or not?
Yeah, it would probably be the equivalent of the 402 error would probably be like, oh, hello, you've been mining cryptocurrency without your knowledge for the last half an hour. But yeah, maybe you could actually. Yeah, you'd see some web page, and then when your payment details don't go through, it'll take you to a 402.
That would be interesting, but probably not one we're going to see at any time soon. I also learned something slightly computer related this week. So a typist, sort of a professional person, doing a day's worth of typing, well, apparently, it's according to one estimate, their fingers will travel 25 kilometres on a QWERTY keyboard across an 8-hour day.
That is interesting.
Oh, wait, I don't understand. So when you say they're moving, you mean the distance that you move as you go from like a Y to a P?
Yeah, all those little small movements between characters, they all build up, basically. And don't ask me for more details, because I don't know any more than that. It was one of the facts on Reddit's Today I Learned.
Of course it was. But it had the air about it.
But it sounds good. It's a good sort of thing that I've learned.
Unverified, sort of, but plausible.
Yeah.
We'll take it.
Have you got something more factual, Matt Reynolds?
Yeah, because I read this in a BBC article. In 1961, in a Russian expedition to the South Pole, the only doctor on the trip fell ill with appendicitis, so he took his own appendix out. operated on himself, general anesthetic. Obviously, he wasn't asleep. Just did a little bit of local anesthetic into the intestinal wall, and then just whipped his own appendix out.
Impressive. Did he survive?
Yeah, he was fine. He was working 2 weeks later.
Wow.
He didn't go. He didn't put himself under general anesthetic until everyone had cleaned up the surgical instrument. So he waited till the room was tidy, and then was like, "Job done."
And then when he trusted everybody, and that was it. That was the moment when he's like, now I'll cut into myself.
Yeah, exactly. No, that was afterwards, so he didn't finish. Oh, so he was like, oh, I'm not going to recover until I've made sure everyone's put away the instruments correctly. So there you go.
Well, I think the lesson of that story is take two doctors on a trip to the Antarctic or somebody else that is able to not cut into yourself.
That must be weird as a doctor, though. Like, how much do you trust another doctor to operate on you? Maybe you'd just be like, you know what? I'm really good at this.
Yeah, like a hairdresser, myself. Maybe.
Yeah.
No, actually, I'm gonna do myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, I think I'll get it the way I want.
But Antarctic medicine's crazy, isn't it? Like the stuff they have to do.
Yeah, it's incredible. Sort of some of the things that they do, and just even to complete these missions at all, it's.
I think they end up often using quite low tech tools. Like if you've got a big cut or something, they can just glue it together and things like that. Because they have to do everything so fast, especially if you're outside. In those freezing temperatures, they've got no time to do anything. They just have to get you into warmth and try and fix you.
Literally a matter of life or death straight away.
Exactly.
Our first story this week, it's been the biggest story probably in the UK, in some sectors, has been the great chicken crisis of 2018, which was, for people that are not aware, KFC, the Kentucky Fried Chicken Company, ran out of chicken. Matt Reynolds.
Yeah, I think in... however many years, our grandkids would say, oh, do you remember the great chicken crisis of 2018? Essentially, this week, 3/4 of KFC stores in the UK, well, mainland UK specifically, ran out of chicken because of a supply chain nightmare.
I think it's pretty fair to call a chicken company running out of chicken a crisis, right? That's
Agreed. But I want to know what actually happened. What was the root cause of all this?
Okay, so there's a couple of kind of factors here that kind of it was a perfect storm of a chicken disaster. So basically, this kind of settles on the fact that on the day the kind of crisis started to take shape, it hadn't hit stores yet. We're talking February the 14th, Valentine's Day. That was the first day that KFC had partnered with their new delivery provider, DHL. Before that, they use another company that I can't remember their name, but basically they'd switched from this provider that had kind of 6 different delivery depots to DHL that only had 1 delivery depot. No problem, right? But the problem is, on the morning of February the 14th, there was a 7-vehicle collision on the M6 between junctions 2 and 3. And later that morning, there was another collision between a pair of lorries on junction 1 of the M6. So basically, there's really, really bad traffic. It doesn't help, actually, that they're having repairs on the M6 as well. So there's a lot of lane closures and stuff like that, which would all be okay, except DHL's only chicken depot was located right in the web of those traffic jams.
So that's what this whole massive thing comes down to. Really? Is it traffic jams?
It is 100% traffic jams. So basically, we had this kind of... these vehicles kind of like couldn't get out on the morning of February the 14th. And eventually what happened is these deliveries weren't reaching the stores. Chicken in the trucks was spoiling. Chicken that was out on the road wasn't able to come out. And so what we saw is kind of 2-3 days later, the crisis properly started to kind of hit because the shops ran out of chicken. You know, they have a certain amount of chicken in the refrigerator. When that ran out, that was when KFC had to shut down, I think, about 600 stores in the UK.
It's a complex situation, which obviously it starts with this one traffic jam and then the incidents that led from there. But there are issues around sort of, should a company be operating a national business out of one sort of supply chain store? Well, not store, but factory.
So it's not unusual, and the reason for this is this depot wasn't just placed anywhere. It was placed in a particularly special area called the Golden Rectangle.
The Golden Rectangle. What? That sounds magnificent. It must be Must be glorious there.
It's beautiful. It's the gateway to anywhere you could want to go within the UK, within the mainland UK. So essentially, the Golden Rectangle is this kind of area between Milton Keynes, Rugby, Daventry and Northampton.
Even when you say it, the glamour, I can picture it. It's glorious.
Yeah, I think I was trying to think about this for any of our listeners that aren't from the UK, trying to kind of like situate, you know, what the kind of US equivalent of Daventry is. And if you watch the US Office, but kind of somewhere like Scranton, it's a proper...
Oh, yeah, it's quite a good comparison, isn't it, actually?
Yeah.
But you two are both from the area, aren't you? I mean, and I can just tell looking at you. Because you look that much healthier. Kind of just like you've lived a better life than the rest of us.
I think one of the things is about the Golden Rectangle, which we obviously refer to every day and sort of those of us that are from there and say a sort of small prayer every morning to the Golden Rectangle.
Which, by the way, and I checked out Google Maps and it's not a rectangle. Not even close.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird kind of triangle with little bits, isn't it?
Well, so, I mean, to be honest, it's a parallelogram if you like tweak the lines a little bit, but they're really in a straight line. So you can make that line of best fit go anywhere you want. But anyway, carry on. Sorry.
But the golden rectangle parallelogram. I can't say that.
You're doing well.
I'm gonna just gloss over that. But this rectangle is really important for UK distribution and actual the supply chain of products that are sort of distributed all around the country, because the area is very central to anywhere. It's pretty much slap bang in the middle of the country, and you can drive probably to the north of England, to the south of England, all in one go from there. And it acts as just a place in the supply chain that is really easy to get stuff out to other areas. And without it, we would probably be struggling a little bit in terms of sort of products moving around the UK, as you can see with KFC. And just from growing up there, me and Matt were discussing before we came on the podcast, like our first driving lessons were around these big industrial estates where there are just loads of big factory depots and warehouses that are huge, great big buildings that just have like loads of delivery companies, logos plastered along the side. And they obviously transport stuff from there to everywhere in the country.
So what I don't understand with this particular KFC shortage is, okay, I get it, there were traffic jams, they couldn't get the chicken out of the depots, it couldn't reach the stores in time, but this seems to have gone on for several days now, and I think even now some stores are only offering a limited menu. Surely as soon as the traffic jam cleared, they could just start getting the lorries out and they'd very quickly get back into business. Like, why does this seem to be such kind of a long problem for them?
I think the problem with this is like I kind of like mentioned earlier on, it was a bit of a kind of perfect storm. So KFC had only just started to use this new supplier on the day that it went wrong. It was a completely new warehouse. It was a completely new IT system. I mean, they kind of sound like a bit rubbishy excuses, actually, don't they? But really, it seems like what happened is that you had this slightly exceptional circumstance with these kind of like traffic jams. And then when it came to kind of, say, dealing with all this spoiled produce, knowing how to respond when you have these trucks on the road that can't kind of go anywhere, their systems were just not set up to handle it. There was no case of, okay, well, great, we can switch to kind of some refrigerated backup, or we can get them from this other depot. This was day one of them working with this new delivery service, and they got the kind of like biggest test that they could get, really, and they didn't really pass it.
And they're quite low margin businesses as well, these ones. They're always looking to slice off just that little bit to save cost. So, I mean, I'm guessing that everything is quite tight in terms of how they do it all. And yeah, that when things go wrong, that means that you don't have so much slack in the system to, I don't know, call in the helicopters or whatever.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the big things about this. Other supply chains from different companies, whether they're in food or whether they're in different types of products that aren't as perishable, they rely on multiple different factories, different depots to get stuff out. And really, they have... when they do have problems, and we've all sort of experienced them, because your parcel will get delayed sometimes from a DHL or somewhere else down the line, they have sort of redundancies in place that will sort of make up for this. But because KFC had all of its chickens come in from one basket...
Hey.
Oh, wow.
What happened? Was it the road?
Nah, you beat me to it. But yeah, it is obviously just this is what's caused it. And what, Matt, is there anything they can learn from this, do you think? Or is it more of a case of this was a one-off, it's probably not going to happen on this scale again?
I mean, doing a bit of Google around this, the M6 is notorious for its traffic jams. I think that there are perhaps a kind of like a couple of things. One counterintuitive thing is, if your entire menu revolves around one food item, particularly fresh chicken and not frozen chicken, if there's a problem in that supply chain, so say if there's some kind of like infection in Britain's kind of like meat supply, you're like really vulnerable to that. I saw that certain KFCs were still open, but they were kind of selling like a limited menu. And I wondered, what would be on that limited menu? Like those little pots of beans they do?
Chips and gravy.
Yeah, exactly. But do you mean like, as in KFC really does just do chicken. It's not like, you know, McDonald's, whereas maybe if the chicken burger was off the menu, that's fine, or whatever. So I think, I mean, that's not a solution. I'm saying, you know, become Kentucky Fried Beef or something. But I think I'm saying that's kind of like, that's always going to be a kind of like a danger. And then secondly, having a contingency plan wouldn't be a bad idea. I was interested. I mean, were any of you distraught? When was the last time you visited a KFC?
It's got to be decades.
I've been vegetarian for a few years now, but I have to say, before that, I did quite like KFC. I mean, there's something about that lovely deep-fried breadcrumb.
Yeah, and
looking good.
For the listeners outside of the UK, there were reports of people calling the police and law enforcement about this about this chicken shortage, and it was really sort of touch a nerve with a lot of people, I think. But a bad week for KFC, I think most people can conclude with that. Vicky, this week you were in Amsterdam for a few days.
I was, well, just one day actually, but I was visiting a new AR, augmented reality, installation there by none other than Brian Eno, the music legend. So yeah, I went to see this installation. It's called Bloom Open Space, and it's by Brian Eno and his frequent collaborator, Peter Chilvers, who has previously worked with him on several of his apps. So you might know Bloom, the app. It came out quite a few years ago now, and this is sort of an AR version of it. And yeah, it was really interesting to see AR applied in sort of a purely artistic, creative way, because a lot of the applications I've seen so far have been very sort of functional, like, oh, this could help you train how to work this special job, or you know, you could see how furniture would fit in your living room or something like that. So I was really intrigued to go and see someone just using it purely for artistic purposes.
First off, what can you describe what the situation was, what the installation was, what you were doing?
Yes,
in the augmented reality.
So it was in this big old warehouse, and you go inside, and the first thing you see is very dark, and there are six screens that kind of mark out a big circle, and on the screens are these kind of digital bubbles that are floating up to the top of the screens, and all the while there's this music playing, and it is very Brian Eno style music. It's synthy, electronic, very kind of relaxed, sort of meditative, with like an ambient background as well, so some, like, you can hear what sounds like crickets chirping and that kind of thing. And when you go into the installation, you're given Microsoft HoloLens, you put that on, and you can see in front of your eyes just a tiny dot, and that is your cursor. And what you have to do is you put your fingers in front of your face and you make a pinching motion, so like pinching your thumb and forefinger together on the cursor, and that creates one of these bubbles. But obviously when you're wearing the AR headset, you can see it in 3D and not just 2D on the screen. And so when you do this, you create a bubble, it's called a bloom. And every time you create a bloom, that also makes a musical note. And what pitch that musical note is depends on your position. So it depends where you are looking, so your height, in terms of whether you're kind of gazing upwards, so the headset is looking for higher up, or downwards, so it's looking further down, and your direction, so which way you're facing. So you can walk around pinching the air and creating all these blooms and making different notes as you go. And you can have 6 to 12 people doing this at the same time, so you're all making different notes and kind of collaborating on this piece together, and creating all these visuals at the same time as well.
So the idea is, it's a group creation of music, basically. It's people coming together to produce something new.
Yeah, music and visuals. And it very much follows on from an idea that Brian Eno has worked with before. So he coined the term generative music, which is basically where you create a system that then makes music, but you don't have control over every aspect of that outcome. So this is the same with his apps, and it's the same with this piece. He has, created the system and decided, what key it's going to be in and what notes it can play, but he doesn't have complete control over the outcome because every person who comes through that space is going to be making different notes and be going to be kind of adapting the music in their own way. So it will never play the same thing twice. It ends up being really interesting. And that said, even though you've got all these people contributing to the musical composition, it doesn't sound like complete chaos because it's actually very limited in terms of what sounds you can make. Some of them do sound nicer than others, but they all, if you're outside of the installation watching from the outside, it all sounds like a nice, relaxing musical track. It doesn't sound weird. And that's because they've kind of coded in all of these limitations and restrictions. So they say that, it will only ever play a sound if that sound is right.
So it's very controlled and very prescribed already. Roland, you look a bit sceptical.
Yeah. Was it fun? Did you, because I know you were there to write about it, but if you'd just been kind of using it as a regular person, do you think you would have enjoyed it?
What I found most interesting about it actually was, I have to say, like, when I first got there, I looked at it and I was like, oh, it seems a bit simple, it didn't blow me away at first sight. But then when I was doing it, I found I just got like really into making these bubbles, and it really does kind of consume your focus, even though it's quite a simple activity. And you're sort of working out in your head, how do you make different pitches of notes? So it's not, you can't like map it out like a keyboard and play a tune, but you can figure out roughly like, oh, that makes a higher note. If I do that, it makes a lower note and things like that. So I did very quickly get kind of wrapped up in it. And I found it sort of relaxing in a way as well, which for me, for AR and VR, is quite a new response to have.
Mm.
Because I think usually they're trying to blow you away with these like, oh my God, you're being chased by a T-Rex experiences, and this was more almost therapeutic. Mm. So you're going around making these bubbles and collaborating with others and kind of having a bit of a I was there with strangers, but you end up kind of interacting with them and sort of making these blooms and music with each other. And when my time was up,
how long does it last?
So, well, I don't know how long people are able to do it for in the rest of the installation, but I had an 8-minute slot because they were getting through a lot of people at once, because it was the first day. When that time ends, you just can't make any blooms anymore. And I was sort of shocked when it ended, and I was like, oh wow, has it already been 8 minutes?
Can we listen to your music?
If you download the app, you can hear something very similar. And there's also a video which is embedded in the piece on wired.co.uk, so you can go and listen to that and get a feel for it. But as I say, it will never sound exactly the same.
And
yeah, it was really. I'll tell you what it almost felt like. It almost felt like I was unplugging for a while, when actually I had this big like digital AR HoloLens set on my head. But because you can't do anything else, this is like 100% your focus. That I think is what really made it enjoyable.
Mm, that is so interesting. I think one of my first ever time I tried a HoloLens in a public setting, I felt very embarrassed because in speaking of like the unexpected social reactions, because I was speaking to someone and I could see a whole bunch of other stuff overlaid on them, and they didn't know it was there, and I really felt intensely the social awkwardness of that. But it just shows like how with these new technologies, they're not exact. It's not just like, how you imagine putting a phone in front of your face.
Yeah.
Right? It's slightly different.
Well, so with this, you could see what other people were creating as well. So it was very
I think
much
that's
shared.
That's really nice because it's a bit more social. It's not so isolating.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's certainly something that I'd be interested to see how people end up using these tools in more of a kind of artistic creation method. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's definitely a different way to do it. And people, I don't think, can, while Vicky just I was going to say quietly dies there, but not so much. I think the exhibition is running for a couple more days. I think it finishes on the 25th, is that correct?
Yeah, so it's running over the weekend, and then I think they are hoping to take it on tour to other places, but there's nothing confirmed yet.
Yeah, but you can read all about it on wire.co.uk and see how the whole experience works. Last year, Google was fined £2.1 billion by the European Commission. This was after a 12-year-long running case about its search competition. Roland, you've been reporting this story for quite a while.
Yes, and before the judgment on Google last year, I spent quite a lot of time writing a big profile of Margret Vestager, who's the European Competition Commissioner. And while I was doing that, I met the couple who are really at the very heart of this case. And the case, they brought the case, and they've been following it intensely all the way along. And they're called Adam and Siobhan Ruff. And they're very careful about how they speak to journalists. They've really got it down. And so what they do is they kind of do these off the record briefings with people. And so I met up with them. We chatted for an hour, and I really, really liked them. And I thought there was something kind of totally incredible about their story and the fact that, I mean, it'd been going on for so long. And I said, hey, listen, look, when you're ready, let's talk and let's try and do like a longer story, really telling the whole story of your case. And so after the judgment, They did get in touch. And so last December, I went out and went around to their house and spent loads and loads of time with them. And then we published the piece, last week.
Yes.
And they also came in a couple of days later, on Valentine's Day, of course. I think is really appropriate, because it is, like, despite it all the details, a very romantic story, actually, about this couple and how they've stayed together despite incredible pressure. And then a couple of days after that, they came in for a podcast. And so yeah, and it's really great to finally, for their story, really finally, to be getting out there.
Yeah, these were the two people behind the entire case against Google. They're the ones that sort of really pursued it, and at times when it looked like Google could be sort of getting its own way in terms of, like, with European commissioners, they were the people that were driving it and sort of really hit it home. And Roland, you run a separate podcast here at Wired, which is called Upvote, which is about tech and politics and sort of everything in that sphere. And as you mentioned, they were on this podcast, which you can find in this same feed. So if you scroll back one podcast, it should just be there before this one, and we're going to have a little clip of that as a taster. But Roland, do you want to explain what's being discussed in this?
Yeah, so the case goes all the way back. The start, the kind of the very origin of the case goes all the way back to a moment in 2006 when the Ruffs put live the website for their company Foundom, and almost immediately they realised that something was wrong, and something was wrong specifically with Google. And what it kind of what turned out was that, well, basically Google was going inside the rankings and poking them down. And so I asked them if they saw it happening on the day it happened, and this was their response.
So on the day it happened, we saw it happening. And you talk about Google in the singular, but actually Google is this distributed set of data centers around the world. So as this penalty was rolling out, we were able to look at data centers where it had gone live and data centers where it hadn't. And for a particular keyword, on the non-penalized data center, we'd be, say, ranking 5, and on the penalized, we'd be ranking 55. So we watched this penalty roll out across the world and effectively disappear our site.
Yes, and all your traffic drops off a cliff with it.
And what did you think?
We knew immediately that we'd been hit by some kind of penalty, which is what Siobhan was describing. This, although Google has hundreds of ranking signals, and it's very easy to confuse people and say, "Oh, you know, it's this esoteric mix." That's true, but at the end of the day, a penalty is a very, very powerful ranking signal that can take all those other ones, and it just swamps it and says, "I don't care that these 500 things say you're highly relevant. This says you're spam or whatever it is. I'm not putting you anywhere near the top of the search results." And our first thought, of course, was that this was an error.
An honest mistake.
Yeah. I mean, any complex algorithm is bound to make errors, have collateral damage, and we expected to reach out to Google and have it quickly corrected or manually intervened or whatever it was they needed to do. And really, we hung on to that belief for a surprisingly long period, given how difficult it is to contact Google. So you're... there's official channels for sites that are illegitimate, that are caught up, for legitimate sites caught up in these penalties to appeal, and unofficial channels. And certainly from the official channels, we got absolutely no reply at all. And we learned years later that apparently Google's response to manual penalties, so if an engineer in Google looks at you and says, you're terrible, they will manually penalise that. And if you complain about that, they'll tell you why, and they'll give you reasons, and they will then lift your penalty. But if you're caught by an algorithmic penalty, they basically take any appeals, tear them up and put them in the bin effectively.
They don't even look at them. So this either, I guess this suggests that internally they assume their algorithms never make mistakes. Which, of course, to anyone who's a techie and knows that every 10 lines of code on average you build in an error, that seems insane.
So there you go. And that was them talking about just that one moment. We spoke for quite a while. They're really amazing characters, so I really recommend listening to the whole thing and to get a sense of this this totally incredible story. And they've also got really strong views on what Google should do and where Google should go next. So, yeah, go check it out.
Yeah, and that's on Upvote, the tech and politics podcast from Wired, which is should be just one before this in the feed. Go and listen to the full interview there. And it's an incredible story, and you can read Roland's sort of written free version of it on wired.co.uk. I think that's all we've got time for this week. So thank you very much for joining us. And we'll speak to you all again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.